Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Los Angeles, the Win Without Competing Show with Dr. Arlene Barrow, Career Coach 1, and author of Win Without Competing. Now, here's Dr. Arlene.
Thank you, Virgil. Welcome to my show. In tough economic times, it is especially important to implement my Right Fit method, which will enable you to win without competing in your career and in your life. Listen to learn about my Right Fit method from my guest interviews. The Ann Edwards brand of celebrity biography. My guest today is Ann Edwards, Pulitzer Prize nominee for her biography, Early Reagan, and internationally best-selling author of Judy Garland, Vivian Leigh, Katharine Hepburn, and Margaret Mitchell, author of Gone with the Wind. A native of Los Angeles, she lived for several decades in Great Britain, where her biographies of Queen Mary, the present Queen's grandmother, Diana, Princess of Wales, Wallis, Duchess of Windsor, and royal sisters Elizabeth I and Princess Margaret are seminal books. Edwards will share memories of her early career as a child performer and her marriage to her third and present husband, Stephen Citron, pianist, composer, noted author of books on the musical theater, and co-author with Edwards on a memoir and a musical. Welcome, Ann, to Win Without Competing.
Well, good day to you, Arlene. How nice to be speaking to you.
It's wonderful, Ann. Take us back to your childhood. In what part of Los Angeles did you grow up, and what did your parents do?
Well, I grew up in what is now a really very chic part of Los Angeles, Beverly Hills. But at the time, when I was a child, Beverly Hills was a little bit more rural than it is today, but it was quite beautiful. My family owned a famous restaurant called Chasen's, and which had a lot of celebrities that came. And we lived in the house that was behind the restaurant. And that was what my early youth was. I was in vaudeville when I was very young. I'm not really greatly talented, I don't think. I sang, but I was able to sing quite loud. And it was a wonderful childhood growing up. Kind of a fairyland, I think. I enjoyed it. Gave me a sense of fantasy.
I know that you appeared with Al Jolson and Ruby Keeler. For how many years did you actually perform as a child star?
Well, not really very long. It happened really kind of surprisingly, just you know, one of those things from left field. Ruby Keeler was a friend of the family, and she and Al Jolson, who were married at the time, were looking for a young person, a young child, right at my age level, that they wanted to include in a stage show that they were doing. It was an Easter performance in the Keith Orpheus circuit, and they needed a child really to come in at the beginning and to go in the end. They had a little storyline that was going, that was holding this thing together, and then they did a lot of songs and so forth, and they needed this person to be able to sing one song and to be able to go up and down the stairs with them, a little bit in the Shirley Temple mode. They thought that it was possible that I could do it for them, and my mother was not really very agreeable to it, but finally she was seduced into it, and there I was. So I played their little girl. It was like for a period of under a year that I did that, much under a year. I think they chose me because I was kind of cute at the time. You know, I was redheaded. I wasn't beautiful, but I had these red curls, and I was very, very outspoken and so forth, and it kind of worked. I don't really remember too much about it so far back in the past. And then after that, I became a Meglin Kitty. I wanted to really go in and learn how to dance a little bit more. My mother, I guess, thought so, if I was going to pursue this. And so I became a Meglin Kitty. And from there, I became part of Gus Edwards' group. He had a kitty group. And that's where the name Edwards came from, because he named just about every kid in the place was with him in the show was an Edwards kid. So I became Ann Edwards at that time. That was only when I was about 7. And it stayed with me. I kept it all my life. And that was it. So I did that for a few years. I did a show with Ken Murray here in Los Angeles. And then I really I got at that awkward stage that young people do. And I didn't feel like going on with it, and no one was pressing me to go forward. And I always really wanted to write. I was a storyteller from very, very early time. I used to write all these little stories and act them out and get my little friends to act them out with me. And when I was just really something like 11, I started writing songs, music, and lyrics and so forth. And that was where I was on my way.
Did your parents do anything to encourage you in terms of the writing realm?
Well, my mother was a teacher originally, an English teacher, you know. So certainly her great influence on me, Arlene, and I think it's so wonderful and should happen today, was the fact that she was a tremendous reader. And what I remember most about her in my childhood, that there was always a stack of books next to her side of the bed, and she was always reading. And before she went to sleep, when she got up in the morning, she loved to read, and she loved to discuss the books with me, and she always went to the library with me. And books were really a very important part of her life, and so obviously they became a very important part of mine. And I think it was a good lesson to be learned.
So she was a wonderful role model, obviously.
Absolutely. Fantastic. And a very beautiful lady, I have to tell you. Beautiful.
Well, you're a very beautiful lady as well.
I thank you, Arlene. I thank you.
In terms of your passion for writing, how old would you say you were when you identified that you were emotionally connected? And the reason why I'm asking is, Anne, I do a lot of career coaching, and what's difficult is for many people to get in touch with their passion. And perhaps if you could describe it, it may help others, even as adults, to get connected to it.
Well, I think it's a passion that was really born in me. As I said to you, I always loved stories. I loved movies. I loved stories. I loved to read fairy tales as a little one. There was that imagination, but it's also a sense of connection that you have. And I think that was what was so wonderful about it for me. I was rather a lonely child. I was an only child. My father was away a great deal of the time. My mother and I were alone quite often, and it was a form of creating another life for myself and connecting. And it was also the ability to really dig down into people's relationships, and it started with each other, and it started really very early in my life. I was published. I had my first published story, as shocking as it seems, when I was 14. There was a contest that the Reader's Digest was running for a story of a reader's the most unforgettable character you ever met. And so I sat down and I wrote it in longhand. We didn't have a typewriter, and I wrote in longhand this memorable person that I had. And I sent it in, and I forgot it. And was something like about 2 or 3 months later when I received a $100 check in the mail, which I thought was a fortune at that time, a fortune, and they published that. I have to tell you, it gave me a sense of great identity. Here I was published, and it was a fantastic thing to happen. I had a great deal of pride in myself. And I went forth. I was also very lucky in that when I was only 17 and living in Los Angeles, I was available to films, and they used to send out scouts, film scouts, that is, and I was no longer interested in performing, but they used to send out film scouts to the high schools and so forth to see if there were any young people who were talented. And this one particular year, the year that I was going to graduate from high school, I had written the book to the school musical. You know, you have the school musical. I thought it was a little corny, but anyway, I did it. School musical, and a really wonderful young fellow that I was working with at the time. We both did, we thought of ourselves as Mickey and Judy, I guess, and eventually writing a great musical thing.
Did you go to Beverly Hills High?
Yeah, I did. I did. And it was his name was Mark Sandrich Jr., and his father had done all the Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire films, you know. So at any rate, we wrote this book. It was, this show was called International House. I won't go into the story, but we presented it at school. But they had a talent scout there, and the talent scout, and there were a lot of wonderful talented kids in the show. I remember that one of Eddie Cantor's daughters was in it. There was a whole bunch of people, wonderful people. And at any rate, the next thing I hear, it's the next day after the show, I get a call from MGM, and they ask me if I wouldn't come out for an interview. I couldn't imagine what I was coming out to an interview for, but I did, not very far from Beverly Hills to where they were in Culver City. So over I went. And what they had was a junior writers program, which was a wonderful thing, and we could use that more in some of these television sections, workshops and things. It was quite wonderful. And they said that they would like me to come on to the junior writers program, which they had at the time. They wanted young writers who they thought would have talent and could, you know, break themselves into film writing. They wanted to start young film writers. And so I went on this program, and I said, well, I want to go to college. I'm planning to go to college. And they said, well, can you put it off for a few months? We'll give you a 6-month contract to do this for 6 months. And I thought, well, that puts me into going into UCLA in February, but okay, you know. So I did, and I had a wonderful experience, and I was able to go through all the different facets that of movie making. They took us through everything, and we got to work with a lot of wonderful people. It was a great experience, and that really started me off. I really started off as a screenwriter, and it was not until a number of years later that I decided that what I really wanted to do was write books, and that I had gone off on this tangent, but what I had really wanted to do was write books, and so I started my first novel, and that was very fortunate. That was published. It was called The Survivors. But that was, you know, midlife
much
or
later,
early midlife.
Yeah, much later.
Yeah, much later. And up until that time, I had really been writing for films and television.
I wanted to step back for a moment about the Reader's Digest article. I was curious, do you remember the woman that you considered most memorable that you wrote about?
Yes, I surely do. I mean, she's still memorable to me, and she was someone I love very much. She was a cousin of mine, and she was a hunchback. And she was, because of it, it dwarfed her slightly, you know, quite a bit, actually. And she was just this wonderful, strong woman with this great personality, wonderful smile, gorgeous big brown eyes that took in the world when she looked at it. And she was very, very wise and never seemed to have a self-pitying time that I was ever with her. There was a time, actually, that we lived together, that she came to live with us. And even then, you know, day and night, she was just a very wonderful, very special person. She died very young. Anyway, that was who it was. Her name was Inez, and I will never forget her. She was really quite unusual.
I think that it's beautiful that at age 14 you were so sensitive to write about her.
Well, I don't know how unusual. I mean, it was it was quite unusual that someone like that should actually become part of my life. That's how I looked at it. I thought it was a rare, special treat because, you know, this was someone with special needs, really, you might think, but she didn't allow that to happen. And she held a very, very good job. She was very intelligent. She had put herself through university. She was really quite a terrific person, and I felt that I was the fortunate one.
In your 20s, you moved to London. How did that come about?
Well, it's a very long story, and you haven't got that much time. But anyway, it had to do with politics. It had to do with a lot of things. And then, really, I was going through a divorce, and the politics were difficult here during the 50s. And I, again, I think fortune has always stepped into my life a lot. I don't know whether I lure it in or not, but it comes often. And there was an English producer that was had come to look for stories and so forth. And my agent introduced him to me, and he asked me if I had any story ideas. I gave him a story idea that I had, and the next thing I know, he optioned it for me to write a screenplay. I assumed that since he was here and he had his production was going to be financed by MGM, I figured it was going to be done in the United States. But indeed, when my agent called, he told me, no, they want you to come to London, and they need you there within about 3 weeks. And I said, did you tell him I have two little children? The oldest was six.
Oh.
And he said, yes, and they've agreed that they will supply a nanny for you in a house and so forth and so on. And there I was. So I went to London. I assumed I was just going to do the one film, and then I didn't know what was going to happen from there. But he asked me to go on to the next project that he had. And before I knew it, Arlene, you know, something like nearly three decades had passed, and there I was.
Yeah, it's just amazing that you lived abroad for so long, Anne. And did you move around always because of your career? Because I know you lived in Britain and you lived in other countries. What exactly motivated the moving along?
Well, the other countries were Europe. They were, you're talking about Switzerland and south of France.
Right.
That's all connected when you live in London, you know, or something. You're very, very close to those places, and you can fly back and forth. It's probably no further than we might go to Seattle, Washington, to get to the south of France, you know, or maybe even shorter than that. I'm not.
You mean from Los Angeles to go to?
From
the,
Los
you know.
Angeles,
right?
You know, or from, you know, if you're not talking about long distances at all, France is after all just across the waters there, you know. It was nothing. So I did. In England, most of it had to do with work, but some of it really had to do with the children themselves, because in England, after 11, what we call public education, which the English just called schools, regular schools, it really stops at 11, and it's the rest of the schooling at that time. The rest of the schooling that was funded by the government was not really really great. And most children with enough ability to get some kind of the ability to go to another school, a better school, or financially was able to do it, had to leave and go someplace else. There were a few boarding schools. That's why they almost all went to boarding schools at that time after 11. And so there were a lot of boarding schools in England, but it just seemed to me that France and Switzerland were good places. So we went down to Switzerland, and my daughter went to a Swiss school. And I think neither one of us have ever regretted that. She's really enjoyed it. That background had been very good. And that was really what happened. Usually there was something that I had to do. I loved Switzerland. My daughter used to say, you know, everything works in Switzerland, even my mommy. They are so organized, you know.
That's terrific.
And I guess I'm a little bit of a ditz, you know, a scatterbrain. My mind is always on my stories. But she felt that even there I was organized there, and that was really quite unusual for me. So, and we lived in the south of France, and I enjoyed that tremendously. But we used to go back and forth to London. And actually, when I did come back to the States, there was a point in my life, and I was writing books at this time, and I felt that I was really losing touch with my own country in terms of what was happening and so forth. When you're not here on a daily basis, it's a different thing, you know. As you feel like you're not making that contact, and I felt I really needed to come home. It was time to go home, and so indeed, that's what I did. I came back to the United States.
I think you were age 41, Anne.
I was 41,
right, when
right.
you returned.
And actually, it was my daughter was ready for college, and my son was already in college at that time. And it was really, because I got married very young the first time. And actually, I didn't know where to go, because in actual truth, I mean, there was no home anymore. You know, my mother was gone. My father, you know, there was no place to go home to. And I said, well, to my daughter, where do you want to go to school? And we were working this out. She had gone to Geneva University for a year, and she was going to switch. So she wanted a school in New England. And so, all right, I said, we'll go to New England, because I wanted to be nearby. So we took a map of New England states, enlarged it, and put it on a wall in the kitchen in this very marvelous, fantastic house that I had in the south of France, and put it on the wall and pinned it up. And she blindfolded me, turned me around three times, and I had a thumbtack, and gave me a push, and she said, okay, Ma. And I walked forward, and wherever my thumbtack hit, that was where we were going to go. And it happened to hit a place called Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and which was really very great. And I said, well, I have no idea. I know it's a good town. They have it's near Lenox and so forth, and it has the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and that sounded very helpful, and it was only about less than an hour from where my daughter was going to go to school. So I said, that's a very good idea. So I wrote them and asked them if they had a Chamber of Commerce. When I left the States, I remembered that the Chamber of Congress used to do everything for you. But I got a reply from a real estate agent who turned out to be a very good, we became very dear friends for life. And she arranged for me to come there to do the thing and everything. And so I arrived in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and there we were, and that was home for me, and it was a rather wonderful turn of events, because that's where I met my wonderful Stephen.
I'd like to talk about your wonderful Stephen a little bit later. I wanted you to share with our listeners how you went from the success of your first book to deciding to focus on in-depth biographies of famous and powerful figures.
It was a progressive thing, Arlene. I didn't realize it, but the books that I chose to do all had, although they were biographies, I mean, although they were fiction and deep stories, you know, and so forth. There was the survivors. There was Shadow of a Lion, which was about the McCarthy period in Hollywood, and those people that went to London. There was one I did about an array of ballet dancer who defected to Paris. I realized that I was doing. Then I did a book called Haunted Summer, which is one of my favorites. It was about Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote and Byron and Shelley, who did Frankenstein. So it was about their summer in Switzerland in 1816, I believe it was. And I realized that what I was doing was doing fictional stories of people that might have lived, or even though I didn't call them who they were, except in The Haunted Summer. But I was moving more towards real life. I was mixing reality with fiction. And so there came a point where I really decided, and then I had one very, very big success, The Survivors, and since it had been so successful, I was very nervous about going into another field. You know, when you cross, it's like crossing over from pop to, from classic to pop or something. You know, I was taking a direct turn, and I knew that that was going to be difficult because I had built up a reading audience in the fiction world, in the fiction department, and here I thought I should cross over to the other. But I took on someone who I had known very well. She, that was Judy Garland, who I had known since I was a child, and had died very recent to that point that I started her book. And she had left me most of her papers and things. I won't go into that, but she had. And she had been in London in the last year of her life. And so I went to my editor, who was Michael Corder at Simon & Schuster, and I first said to him, you know, I have all this material, and I think maybe if you have someone that could do, who is a biographer, I do feel that this story needs to be written, because there's going to be an awful lot of books about her that are, that would be very unpleasant, very unhappy, and I really feel that I could, that what the material I have would be helpful. So he said, well, let me see the material. When I showed it to him, he said, well, there's no reason, Anne, you're going to write this book. So that's what really happened. He pushed me into it because he knew that I was, this is where I was headed. And that's what he told me. He said, you've been heading this way a long time, and this is where I think that you'll do well. And he put money on the line, so I guess he believed me, believed in me. And I was doing, I did that book, and I'm very pleased with it. I think I would never again write a book about someone I knew that well. But as a book, it's because it tears you apart. It's because, particularly if the life has been sad in so many places, it's the one thing I don't want to do autobiography, my autobiography, because there are so many people whose lives have crossed mine that I feel are they're very sad, and I don't think I want to live with that again. You know, relive those days. And particularly, as was with Judy, I felt, if I had known this, maybe I would have been able to help a little. Maybe I wouldn't have, maybe I would have. But in the meantime, there were so many things that disturbed me and so forth. It was very disturbing. I found myself very hard to sleep at nights, and I really went through a very difficult period writing the Garland book. But on the other hand, I felt that I had probably written the book that I wanted to write, that it really portrayed Judy in the light that I wanted to see her portrayed, because I felt that she was a survivor, not a victim, and that she had survived as long as she did was sheer miracle. So I really wanted to show the grit of the woman, and I did. So anyway, that was that. And from there, I went on to Vivian Lee, and then that was the course. I have, through the years, turned back to fiction occasionally, and I do really enjoy doing it. Some of that fiction also has been based on biographical material. But I like to feel that I can do both. In fact, I've just finished a novel, so and I'm hoping that it will reach publication and people will enjoy it.
I wanted to hear about, and I know our listeners as well would like to hear, about your biography of Early Reagan, for which you were mm-hmm. nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Could you explain sort of the whole process of the research? I think that would be interesting to hear about that, as well as why you selected Reagan per se to talk about the early years.
Well, I felt that the early years were something that had, first of all, when you want to write a biography, when you feel I had wanted to write a book about Reagan. First of all, I knew him slightly, but only in kind of a professional manner. But he had made a dramatic change in his political beliefs at a certain point in his life. He was also a president of the Screen Actors Guild for a section of his life, and I had been president of the Authors Guild for a number of years, for 8 years. And there was a lot of things that I wanted to investigate. We came from two different political viewpoints, and I felt that was a challenge. I wanted to see if I could understand what made him tick, how come he changed his viewpoints, what happened. I wanted to investigate that. And his youth really interested me, his background, tremendously. I'm really interested in people's early years. I think they're the formative years, and whenever I do a biography, I always go in depth in the person's early years. This turned out, really, I didn't at the time think I was just going to do his early years. He was governor at the time I wrote the book, and I thought I might go into that, but as I began the book, it became clearer to me that this was the formation of the man. At that time, I had no idea that he was going to become president of the United States. But by the end of the book, I guess that it was very possible. By the end of the time I was writing the book, I went to Dixon. When I do research, I really like to put myself right where my character is. And so I went to Dixon. And that's where he grew up, Dixon, Illinois. And I spent many, many months in Dixon. And it's a small town. I got to know all of his close friends, his teachers, the cousins, his families. I went to all the places he went to, the young woman that he was originally engaged to. I went up to Eureka College and spent a lot of time there with his coach, football coach and so forth, and his swimming coach and all these people. I like to do a lot of recordings. I do recorded interviews so that I have it all on tape and so forth. And as I went along, I realized I really had a fabulous story of the growth of this man. It really turned out to be a life experience for me, and I must say that I really rate it as one of the books that I think I learned as much from it in writing it as maybe anyone else will from reading it. And the other book I can say that about is Matriarch, Queen Mary, but I really do feel that, and so it's always been a special favorite of mine. And I was pleased at the end that the book was reviewed in a very even-handed way. They knew what my political views were, and I think that they appreciated that I was trying not to editorialize at any point. I was putting this man's life forward as it was, and that's how I got into it. I tell you, I had a big surprise, Arlene. Flash forward a lot of years when I decided just about 6 years ago to do a second book, which is called The Reagans, Portrait of a Marriage, going on then from the governorship into his presidency and then his early Alzheimer's. And so I was back living in Los Angeles at that time, back in Beverly Hills I'm living in, as a matter of fact. And so I went to the library, and I found, you know, Reagan Library in Simi Valley, and I was very pleased to find that early Reagan was being used by the docents as a reference, as they were going around showing the various displays of his early life and so forth, and they were telling the stories from my book. I found that very, very rewarding. Very rewarding, yes. So that was very good. And that's how I got into that. Anyway, it took a couple of years of my life, and several years, and it was worthwhile.
What did you learn about Reagan that surprised you?
Well, I think first off, what really surprised me and carried through all the way was his great intelligence. because none of us in Hollywood in the early years, or even with his early pictures, even if you were a moviegoer, thought of Ronald Reagan as an intellectual of any sort. You know, I mean, you just didn't. He didn't come off on screen that way. There was just something about him that reflected. I don't know, what shall I say, just Mr. Average Joe, you know, kind of guy. I was just shocked, really, to find the depth of his intelligence. He was a very, very brilliant man, and I had to give him great marks for it. He had a prodigious memory, and it was a photographic memory, and he could just memorize just about everything. And that's what he did in school because he was terribly, terribly nearsighted, and he never could see the board or read the, you know, and so forth. So he used to memorize everything so that when he got into class, he would be able to answer correctly. And he taught himself how to memorize when he was very, very young. They didn't put glasses on him until he was almost 12, 11 and a half, and up until that time, he saw a blur in front of him practically for his early life. So they couldn't afford glasses is one of the reasons. So this is depression time, bad times, and so forth I'm talking about. So anyway, that was probably the thing that surprised me the most, pleased me the most. And the second thing, I think, is that the more that I read about his years at the Screen Actors Guild when he was president there, was his brilliance in his negotiating abilities. And he certainly was a fantastic negotiator. I was not pleased with many of the results of what he did, which does not mean that I didn't admire him for his ability to get to where he wanted to go. But at any rate, he was a tremendous negotiator. And I think those things are what the book brought forward. And there was a lot of material in there that no one had ever had before, and which I seem to find being quoted constantly in every book on Reagan that is published since that time.
Well, you set the standard, Anne.
I set the stage. I'm not sure I set the standard early.
Well, I think you're setting the standard. Let me ask you, too, about his relationship with Nancy. I mean, we know it was a right-fit marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have insight as to what were the components that created the right fit marriage?
I do, but I tell you honestly, I think it goes into great depth and into things that can be found in the book. I'm not trying to sell the book or anything. Get it at the library if anyone wants to. I'm a great backer of public libraries. But I really go into that very deeply in the book. But a lot of it really had to do with the things that they were minus in their own life, that were absent in their own life, the things that they were seeking when they were younger, and so forth. And it seemed to kind of, when they came together, they seemed to match up, you know? And it was really, Nancy really needed a man that thought of her as being everything for her. She had a great respect for her stepfather, but he was a stepfather. Her own father really deserted her and so forth. She had a lot of needs that Reagan was able to answer. And Reagan really needed someone who really was willing to dedicate her life to him. And that's where Nancy really came in. She did, which Jane Wyman had not. And most of the women that he had known or had affairs with in Hollywood had not. They had their own careers. They had their own thing. Nancy had a career, but really what mattered to her was marriage and Reagan. And I think that's what it really was. And she devoted her life to him. They were complete together.
You had mentioned that you just finished writing a novel. Are you able to share the title of that novel?
Yes, it's called The Marchesa, and it's really just finished recently, and it goes back to the turn of the 20th century. It does take place in at first in Louisiana, New Orleans, and then in the early days of Los Angeles, 1886 and so forth. And it's about a strong woman of mixed heritage and color who wants to make a life for herself and knows she can't do it in Louisiana. And comes to Los Angeles, which was then very much Latino, and she comes to Los Angeles, and she is a very really becomes a tremendous businesswoman. She has vineyards and so forth, and she's a very strong woman and goes through a great many upheavals and things in life. And it's about the early history of Los Angeles and about a woman's independence.
In terms of your next book, do you
think yes.
that you will do another biography?
Do I think I'll do another biography? I'll tell you, I always say that what I have are epiphanies. I never say, all right, the next time I'm going to do this, or the next time I'm going to do that, or I want to, you know. And I have never yet written a book that, say, a publisher or an agent suggested I did. No, that's not true. I did one. But out of my 20-some-odd books that I've written, only one was, and that was the DeMille book, was a book that actually I was asked to do and did. The rest of the books are books that I really came to myself for particular reasons. And usually what happens to me, I will wake up one morning or two mornings or three mornings, and something has come to my head, and which is a question. If you're going to write a biography, you really need a question. There has to be something that you feel hasn't been answered publicly about that person's life. There's some mystery that's involved in that person's life, and that needs to be answered. I always call myself, you know, the Miss Marple of biography. Lady detective. But that's the way that it really has to be. There has to be something that has to be solved. I don't pick someone just because they're a famous person and I think, oh boy, because it's Katharine Hepburn is going to sell, or Vivian Leigh, or whatever. In fact, Vivian Leigh, Michael Corder did not want to publish a book about Vivian Leigh. He didn't think that she would be popular to the American reading public. She was English. The one film they knew about her really that they it was really Gone with the Wind, and he just felt that that would not be a book that I should follow because I had a very good success with the Garland book. But there was such a mystery about Vivian, and I won't go into it, but there was about what made her who she was and so forth, and I was fascinated with her and as a person, not just as an actress at all, but as a human being. And because of that, that's why I fought through, and I said, this is what I want to do, and he finally agreed to let me do it. It turned out to be the biggest bestseller I ever had. It was, I forget how many weeks, 16 weeks at number one on the bestseller list in New York, and there were only 10 books at that time, and it really was a very big, a universal, went around the world, it was a very big bestseller. And it's still, I think people still remember that book, and I think that it was possibly one of the best things I've written, or one of the closest I ever came to get under the skin of someone. And in order to write a good biography, I think that's what you have to do. Does
now,
that help you?
Yes, that helps me, because I wrote my doctorate.
So if you want to know what I'm going to write next,
I haven't
had that epiphany yet.
right, no. Well, I wrote my doctoral dissertation on creativity in writers, and I think I'm struck with how your creative process matches what I had written about in terms of how people go about being creative. And I think
uh-huh.
a beautiful job of explaining it so people could relate to it. Now, to your wonderful husband, Stephen.
Yes.
You've been married more than 30 years.
Yes, we have close to 40.
Oh, boy. How did you know that he would be the right fit? I know that
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't, darling.
You didn't? Because
I
didn't. I know you had two marriages before that weren't the right fit. And
no, they really weren't. And no, I can't blame those two gentlemen, but they certainly weren't the right fit for me, or maybe I wasn't the right fit for them. However, I had two wonderful kids that came out of them, but out of those marriages, and I learned a lot from each marriage. But it was just a matter of chemistry. Let's put it that way. There was tremendous chemistry. He just seemed to really have his mindset was very much the same as my mindset. He was interested in all the things he really loved, all the same things I loved, and disliked all the same things I disliked. I don't know that that's right for everyone, but after the two marriages before and a couple of very unpleasant affairs, some were not that unpleasant affairs, you know, in which I had some affairs with some very powerful gentlemen. This was just really right. We both just loved music, the theater. We were both creative, so we understood what living with a creative person meant, you know. You didn't demand the same things perhaps out of them that someone who wasn't creative might demand out of another person, you know. It was all of those things that were involved. It was difficult for both of us were just recently out of a marriage. We were both just recently separated and on our way to divorce. So we were vulnerable. I think that was part of it. And you've met Stephen, so he just was an easy person to fall in love with.
Well, he's lovely. He's absolutely lovely.
He really
lovely.
Is. No, he is. He's a great. He has a great view, take on life. You know, he's a very positive person, and he has a great take on life, and he's able to really deal with a lot of life's problems and come up smiling no matter what it is, you know, and come up with something. It's really been very lucky. I could wish that on all the people I love that they have that kind of a relationship with the person that they settle down with. It was really just wonderful. We could have really walked away from each other, to tell you the truth, because there were moments in the very beginning where I think both of us said, my God, we just got out of these terrible relationships. What do we want to get back into something again for? You know, because I came to Stockbridge thinking, forget it, you know, I might as well wear high collars and go to a nunnery or something. I'm just not interested. But I don't think he was very pleased to get involved in anything, because his marriage had been very difficult and the divorce had been harder. So I don't think so. And he had a little boy, you know, 4.5 years old at the time.
Oh.
So I think that you know, we had those things and we overcame them very quickly. That was it. We just knew very early in the relationship that this was it for the two of us.
What motivated you to buy the inn in Stockton and to write the
Stockbridge,
book?
Stockbridge, that was.
Stockbridge, yes. Stockbridge.
Yeah.
The Inn and Us.
To write the Inn and Us. Well, actually,
Steve,
actually, it was Steve that bought the inn in Stockbridge. Steve is a musician, and he's a tremendous musician, and he was also a teacher and all these other things, but he was really a musician. He played in a lot of clubs in New York, all the well-known clubs in New York, and he had been Edith Piaf's accompanist. And, you know, he had kind of been through that kind of tough, rough kind of life, and he had a little kid, four years old, or 3.5 at the time, and his marriage was going on the rocks. And he really decided he had to get out of New York and out of the nighttime club life and so forth and so on. And he always liked to cook, and he still likes to cook, and he likes to eat. So he made this decision, which was kind of a crazy decision for him. This is before I came along, he saw this wonderful place, and he decided that was for sale, and he decided he would buy it. It was an old Christmas, it was called the Christmas Tree Inn, and it had once been a coaching stop back in the 19th century. And so he bought it, and turned it into this inn, and then the marriage went to pieces within months after that. So there he was alone at the inn. So when I came in, and as you know, I was raised behind a restaurant and the theater and so forth, and I understood entertainers and so forth. And so I just really, the door was open, and I walked in, and there we were. We were just really right together. So we ran the inn. It had, there were a lot of wonderful things that happened in that the inn, and a lot of experiences we had. It was open only for about four to five years. And then we realized that it really we had outgrown the inn in terms that it was each other that we really needed, and we never were just innkeepers. The inn was our secondary thing. But it was consuming most of our life, because music was always first with Steve and writing was always first with me. And so here we were balancing these balls, you know, and kids as well, teenage kids, 4.5-year-old, you know. It became too difficult. So we sold the inn. And then after we sold it, we thought it's really a fable. It's a story that so many people have this dream of running an inn, of living this kind of a life. And we knew from the inside what it was like. And since I was a writer and had a publisher, I suggested it. I told my editor about it, and she says, well, why don't you two write the book together? And so we did, and that's how the book came about.
And then you went and purchased Mr. Blanding's dream house.
Right, we did. Yes, I've lived in a lot of famous houses.
I know.
All
it's
my
really
accidents.
Interesting.
Yes, it's
yeah.
really crazy. The house that I had in the south of France was the where I, when I lived in the south of France, was the house that they had filmed a picture that starred Julie Andrews. It was called Star, and it was about Gertrude Lawrence and so forth. And anyway, that house was there. And I got that house because my ex-husband was a producer, and that's how we got in, I finally got that house. But it had been a famous house because it had also been, it led right onto the Mediterranean, onto the sea, and it had these 39 steps that went down to like an underground passage to the sea. And it was really the house that was the basis of the idea for the book that was written, that the film was then made of the 39 steps. And so that was a rather famous house in this Tambouvier-sur-Mer that I lived in at that time. And it was quite an experience there. And then Mr. Blanding's house was really much more accidental than that, because here I was now, and we decided to sell the inn. We sold the inn, and we decided we would go to Connecticut. My mother was originally from Connecticut. I won't go into that whole story, but I don't know, out of all the places that we wanted to go, we wanted to be close enough to New York, you know, all of that back and forth. Steve had a studio at Carnegie Hall. So we wanted to be in Connecticut, and we had really picked the area where it's Roxbury, Kent, Sherman, all around in there, so which is a very beautiful area of Connecticut, wooded area and mountainous area. So we were looking there, and I said to the real estate agent, she was taking us to all these places that looked like it was California Valley or something like that. I mean, everyone, it seemed to be, you know, all this countrified kind of thing. And I said, look, do you have, I mean, you know, I don't want to just move into a house. Do you have a house that's a challenge, that needs something, that needs to be loved, you know? Do you have some? She said, well, I have a couple of them, you know, but I thought you'd rather have, you know. I said, no, let's, well. So anyway, the first house that she took took Steve and I to was really too much of a challenge. It looked like it was falling down. The second house, she didn't even mention it was Mr. Blanding's dream house as she took me in, but we fell in love with it from the moment we did, and it did have a lot of serious problems that had to be taken care of. And so we went in, and then she said, oh, by the way, you know, this is the Mr. Blanding's dream house, and I thought, well, it was meant to be, you know, that we would get another film house.
after the movie, right then, Ann?
Oh, yes, after the movie.
After the movie.
Yeah, actually, Dorie Sherry had lived right down the road from the house and so forth. It was right, and the house was really wonderfully set. I loved the house. We only sold it in 2000. We lived there for way over 20 years, 28 years, I think. We really loved the house. But, you know, there's a time in life where you have to move on, and that was the time. So I hope someone else is enjoying it now.
You have had many right fits throughout your career and one right fit husband out of three.
Yeah, pretty good average, don't you think?
What advice do you have?
Although the other two didn't quite, I don't know, the other two didn't quite make up for just getting one.
What advice do you have for our listeners who may be struggling with their careers and personal lives?
Oh, God, I can't really speak for everyone, and I don't like to give advice. I think you have to lead with your heart first and follow with your mind. That's what I think. And I think it's true whether it's your career or whether it's your relationships with friends, with lovers, with husbands, with wives, with whoever it is. I think that's it. I think you have to feel something in your heart first for the career, what you're doing, that the work that you're in is the kind of work that you think you'd be happy in, that you feel content with. And I don't mean it has to be creative. I mean, whatever it happens to be, there are many, many more people in this world who are really not creative there, but they have an organized thought, or they have a leaning towards something that I would never have and really envy quite a bit. So, you know, I think you have to kind of go with what the flow is and not try to be anything that someone else wants you to be or that society says that you should be or, you know, or that you feel that, you know, that it might in some way not please a certain person or whatever, you know. I mean, so many young people do things to please their parents or, you know, or husbands do things to please their wives and to support their families. I'm afraid I'm much of a free thinker. I think you're going to be much more successful if in your work, whatever you choose is your life's work, if it's work that you really love to do, if you're happy in it. And I think you always will succeed if that's the case. You may not succeed on the level financially that perhaps you dreamed one day you would do, but I guarantee you, you're going to have a better life.
Your children, has either of them become a writer?
Well, both of them have talents in the writing field, but on a kind of different level. My son was a political speechwriter. Actually, he worked for Bobby Kennedy and Charles Goodell and Bella Adsug and now he has been for years director of the teachers union, and he teaches and so forth. So I would say that yes, he writes, you know. And he's been very successful in what he does. It would not be, I guess, termed as the same kind of he does political writing mostly, but he certainly is a writer. My daughter is in fashion. She really started in writing. She was a book editor for a short time, children's book editor, and because she was trying to find herself. She was always a good artist, but, you know, that's a very difficult thing to try to find a job in. So she was always a good artist and designer and so forth. And then she was in fashion, and she's in fashion, and she has her own company, but she also deals with other companies. She's a partner with Donna Karan and something and so forth and so on. So they've been both successful in what they're doing, and I think writing has been like part of what was part of their life. And I was always sure that there were a lot of books like my mother had, you know, around the house, so that they were always readers.
Well, Ann, it's just been delightful chatting with you today. And I hope that you will join me again soon. Is there anything more that you would like to add before we close?
No, I just want to wish everyone happy holidays, whether they're Passover or Easter or whatever it is. May they have happy holidays. May they have good thoughts and a good life.
Thank you so much, Anne, and we look forward to reading your next book.
Oh, well, that's good. Thank you. It was good to be with you, Arlene.
Next week, we will not be doing a show. That's Wednesday, April 8th. Please join me the following Wednesday, April 15th, at 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. My guest will be Rosie Lee Hooks, a multifaceted career phenomenon. Rosie is the director of the Watts Towers Arts Center, the tour program for Watts Towers, and the Charles Mingus Youth Arts Center. Digging deeper, Rosie is an award-winning actress who won the prestigious NAACP Image Award for Best Supporting Actress. She toured the United States and Europe with the Mark Taper Forum. At the Smithsonian Institution, she served as a diplomatic liaison and director of field research. And then, tune in to learn more. Save the date. Barrow Global Search, Inc., of which I am the founder and CEO, is conducting a national contest to identify one right-fit unemployed candidate to coach live on this show. On Wednesday, April 22nd at 5 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, we will announce the winner and do the coaching. Please follow subsequently the winner walking down the right fit road until he or she hears you're hired. For more information about my book, visit winwithoutcompeting.com. and drbarrow.com. To reach me, call 310-441-5305 or email drbarrow@winwithoutcompeting.com. Remember this trigger tip. It's all up to you to change your career and your life. Goodbye for now. This is Dr. Arlene, author, Win Without Competing, Career Coach One, founder and CEO, Barrow Global Search,